Today we're going to be interviewing Michael Cremo. And I'm going to be asking him some pretty interesting questions. He wrote a book called Forbidden Archaeology. But he gets into a lot of things because a lot of his early teachings and learning was around the Vedic literatures and from the different perspectives. He's going to be giving a workshop, in case you're interested, July 11th, 2017, up in Mount Shasta. It's called the Gaia Symposium, and you can get more in touch with that with www.awakewithinthedreamproductions.com. Now let's see what Michael has to say. So, today we're going to be interviewing Michael Cremo. Hello again, Michael.
Good to be with you, Rahasia, and all your viewers.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very important. You know, I've been thinking about this. I've been following you now for quite a while, and I've noticed along the way that some of the things you've done, like this thing you did with, what was his name? Carlos Ribeiro. You know, these things are, they go unnoticed, but if people like you don't pull these things out of the back rooms and make sure they're labeled properly, the new generations comes in and sees the evidence and goes, oh, it's only a few thousand years old, and they don't know the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. Carlos Ribeiro was a geologist in Portugal in the 19th century. Actually, he was the chief government geologist of Portugal, and he found many hundreds of stone tools in his country of Portugal. He found them in layers of rock that are about 20 million years old. They come from a geological period called the Miocene, and actually they date back to the early part of the Miocene period, which would make them about 20 million years old. And as a professional geologist, he said these things really do belong in the layers of rock in which they are found. You know, they didn't slip in through some crevice or fissure from some higher, more recent level. In other words, they're not intrusive into the formations in which they are found.
Right.
So he collected hundreds of these artifacts, and he displayed them in the Museum of Geology in Lisbon with labels indicating a Miocene age of 20 million years or more. And it's interesting what happened. After he died, his colleagues in the museum left the objects on display in the museum, but they wrote new labels for all of them, giving them far younger ages. They thought 20 million years, that's impossible. Humans like us could not have existed so far in the past. They thought they're about 20,000 years old. That sounded more reasonable for tools of that kind. So they called them what they determined to be Upper Paleolithic tools. And in terms of years, they considered them to be about 20,000 years old. So they wrote new labels for all of the artifacts. And then the next generation of officials in the museum in the 1950s just put the entire collection away. And they're no longer mentioned in the textbooks of archaeology today. So for most people, including professional archaeologists, they simply don't exist. It's only someone like me who's aware of the history of the reports that Carlos Ribeiro published and scientific journals in the 19th century in the Portuguese and French languages.
So, Michael, let's talk a little bit about where you get your information. A lot of it's from the Puranas, the Vedic literature, right?
Well, that's the inspiration for my work. Actually, until I began studying the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, I really didn't have any reason to question what I'd always learned from my teachers in high school and university. I mean, they were teaching the idea that humans like us appeared fairly recently on this planet. Today they would say about 200,000 years ago, not much more than that. Although there has been a recent discovery in Morocco of some human skulls that are causing them to think, well, maybe we've been around as much as 300,000 years, which in my mind is a tiny step in the right direction,
right?
But it's only a tiny step.
So Michael, Michael, I'm just wondering.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, all of this information, I can see why it's been hidden for the religions, because this is could be a devastating blow to a lot of fundamental religions. But sometimes I think there's a deeper reason why the powers that be want to hide this from us. Why do you think they want to hide who we are, where we came from, how we got here? All of this information is suppressed. And as you answer this, tell me what you think about the Smithsonian Institute, because they seem to play an integral part in hiding a lot of evidence.
Yeah, well, the evidence that I've documented in my book, Forbidden Archaeology, shows that humans like us have been on this planet for many millions of years, going all the way back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth, which means the current scientific explanation of human origins is wrong. And you might wonder, as you were expressing in your question, well, why not, in the face of the evidence, just change the theory? Why not do that? Why resist the evidence to the current theories so heavily? And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is it's just human nature. You know, for example, if I love somebody and somebody tells me something bad about the person I love, I don't want to believe it. I may even become a little angry at the person who tells me. So scientists today are very much in love with their theories. And therefore, when they hear something that contradicts a theory that they deeply love, they tend to resist that and may even become a little bit angry.
You know what?
Sometimes.
I think you're being kind, because sometimes I think they're more in love with their grants, because I've noticed a lot of them sort of base their decisions outwardly to the academia one way, but inwardly, they're not really so much in love with some of these ideas and theories. But if they break away from the mainstream, they get marginalized. I mean, I guess you could probably speak to that better than most.
Yes, that can happen. And that's an additional feature of this process of what I call knowledge filtration in the world of science. Yeah, you know, for example, there's the work of Virginia Steen McIntyre, who's an American geologist that I know personally. In the 1970s, when she was a young woman, you know, just beginning her career in geology, she was actually a rising star in her profession. She had invented a new method of dating volcanic deposits. She was getting grants, as you say. She was getting invited to speak at major international scientific conferences. And, you know, she was called down to a site in Mexico where some American and Mexican archaeologists had discovered stone tools and weapons, and they wanted to know how old these things were. So they called a team of geologists down to the site, including Virginia Steen McIntyre, and she and her colleagues used four different scientific methods to date the site, and they came up with an age of about 300,000 years. But the archaeologist at the time refused to accept that. They thought, according to our theory, humans capable of making these artifacts didn't exist at that time. What to speak of being present in North America? You know, the current consensus among the mainstream scientific community is that there's no humans in North America before 20,000 years ago. No humans in North America any earlier than 20,000 years ago. Now, so they refused to publish the age for the site.
Didn't she? I think she sidestepped them and produced her own paper, huh?
Did, but when she did that, she experienced an extreme negative backlash from her colleagues in the scientific world. She got labeled as a publicity seeker, a maverick. She lost a teaching position that she held at a university in the United States. The grant money stopped coming in. As you were mentioning, these are some of the pressures that can be put on scientists who step out of line. So there's tremendous pressure for conformity.
Okay.
You know, there's a little bit of license, but when you step radically outside the dominant consensus, you find yourself in trouble.
Michael, let's do this. Let's follow the money. The money for the grants comes from Rockefeller Foundations, different places. Who do you think those people are, and why do they not want to let us know the truth? Because I think that they know the truth. Why is it that they think they should hold this down and suppress the truth?
I think the main reason is that the alternatives that are being proposed to the current mainstream scientific theories involve non-material principles. And the current theories of human origins and the origin of life generally are extremely materialistic. For example, an English scientist put it like this. You know, we are survival machines. We are robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. In other words, they define our existence in purely material forms.
Right.
You know, the scientist I was talking about, his name is Richard Dawkins, but they define our existence in purely materialistic terms. They say we're just machines made of molecules. As far as consciousness is concerned, that's just a temporary byproduct of bioelectrical activity in the brain. At the time of death, when the chemicals in the brain become disorganized, there's no more consciousness. And if you define your existence in purely materialistic terms, then automatically your goals and values and objectives in life will become extremely materialistic.
Right.
You will think that to produce and consume more and more material things is the main purpose of human life. And there have been huge political, financial, economic and social and educational institutions that have been built up on that foundation. And there's tremendous resistance to anything that would shake those foundations, because it would be very damaging to the political, economic, and financial institutions that are built on that foundation. What if we had a different concept of human origins? Well, instead of seeing ourselves as machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival in this world, dividing ourselves up into so many competing, conflicting groups, we were to have the understanding, hey, I'm a being of pure consciousness. You're a being of pure consciousness. We're all beings of pure consciousness. We're all related on that level. Let's find a way to satisfy our material needs in the most simple, natural, efficient, and fair way possible, instead of dividing. You know, it would be a completely different set of political, economic, and financial institutions that would develop. Yep. And I think there are powerful interests in society that don't want to see that happen. And therefore, there's such tremendous resistance to any exploration of alternative ideas that would change these fundamental concepts of human origins that are entrenched in the scientific and educational institutions at the present moment. That's what I think is really behind it.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to Bruce Lipton the other day, and it came up about this subject. A lot of the sciences, physicists, biologists, chemistry, there's something going on the forefront of exploration in science right now where it's reversing. They're starting to see consciousness as part of the foundation of our matter fields. And this gets back into a lot of what the Vedic literature says, you know. And now, like Bill Campbell was saying, we live in a holographic projection of consciousness. This is more like a simulation. And they even have the math, you know, the fractal geometry, all of the math underlying these principles to show that this almost has to be a projection of consciousness. And I think the more people listen to people like yourself, that's out of the normal flow of things, the indoctrinated story, you might say, it opens us up to even more incoming flows of energy, no matter what field you're in. You know, like I publish a magazine, I've written a couple books, but all of the people that I've ever interviewed, every single one of them, from their perspective, opens up another line of thought in my mind that feeds into my own life and shows me a picture of a world that a lot of us are envisioning. And it's sort of like the caterpillar becoming the butterfly. You know, it's that part in the middle that they have these things called imaginal cells that imagines what the caterpillar can be. And I think it's people like yourself. Mm-hmm. You're an imaginal cell. You're imagining what it is that is our possible future by looking back in our past and seeing, where did we come from? Who are we? How did we get here? These are such important questions that have been fed into us through religion mostly, then early science, like you were saying, Newtonian science, you know. So, you know, there's a...
Yeah, I think there's relationships between the two. You're right.
Yeah. You know, like we've been sort of dancing on the edge of this cliff here, you know. I'd like to take you over the edge, if you don't mind, and ask you some questions about... Because I know you had to give this some thought about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti. What is the reality there, you think? Because there seems to be something to it that you can't really pin down, but yet, why don't we find something?
In my book, Forbidden Archaeology, I've got a chapter on evidence for living ape men. And there are scientists who believe they have found physical traces for living ape men who are known in different parts of the world by different names. In North America, they may be called Sasquatch. In Central Asia, Yeti, you know, in the Himalayan mountains, the abominable snowman. You know, there are different names for them in different parts of the world. So I think what the real situation is that today, humans like us are coexisting on this planet, not only with various species of apes and monkeys, but with intermediate beings of the Sasquatch type. And I think the same thing was also true in the past, millions of years ago. I think there were primitive apes and monkeys. There were also ape man-like creatures like Sasquatch or Bigfoot. And there were also human beings like us. So I think that's the pattern that emerges if you really look at all the evidence, one of coexistence rather than the evolutionary concept that at one time there were only primitive apes and monkeys, then there were ape men, then there were humans like us. I think just as today we're coexisting with all these types of creatures, in the distant past we also were. But there's another element to this, because as I was mentioning before, I don't think we are just machines made of molecules, purely materialistic beings. I think that molecules, that's part of what we are. But beyond that, there is a subtle mind element that's associated with the human organism that has some very unusual powers like telepathy, psychokinesis, mind over matter, powers like that. And just as it's been demonstrated that human beings can possess these powers like remote viewing and other types of paranormal powers, I believe these ape men or Sasquatch or Bigfoot or Yeti also possess paranormal powers. They're able to cloak their existence. They're able to communicate telepathically. They have what we might call mystic powers or yogic siddhis. And there are descriptions of these creatures in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. They were called Vanaras, which means forest dwellers. And they had ape-like bodies, human-like intelligence, but it's also stated they had mystic powers. And I think that is one reason why it may be so difficult for scientists who are relying on purely material and physical research methods to get a complete grasp on these creatures. And I think there are many people who have reported having paranormal kinds of exchanges with these creatures.
Well, they must be fairly intelligent to stay out of our world, because that would be devastating for their world, I'm sure. Tell us a little bit, since we're into the Bigfoot and Bigfoot country. I live up here in Northern California. What do you have to say about the discoveries that were made in the gold mines up here?
Well, this is one of the most fascinating cases of forbidden archaeology that I've encountered. In the 19th century, gold was discovered in California, and miners came from around the country and around the world, actually, to get it. And they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains like Table Mountain in the Sierra Nevada Mountains near the town of Sonora in north central California. And deep inside these tunnels in the solid rock, the miners were finding human bones and human artifacts. And what makes these things so interesting to me is that, according to modern geologists, the layers of rock in which these objects were found are about 50 million years old, dating back to the early part of the geological period called the Eocene. These discoveries came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California, and he wrote a massive book about these discoveries that was published by Harvard University in the year 1880. But, you know, we don't hear hardly anything about these discoveries today. They're not going to be mentioned in today's textbooks of archaeology because of the process of knowledge filtration I was talking about. I mean, you were talking about the Smithsonian Institution and their role in this knowledge filtering process. Well, there was a contemporary of Dr. Whitney's. His name was William Holmes, and he was an anthropologist employed by the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And here's what he said about the discoveries published by Dr. Whitney. He said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have come to those conclusions that he published in that book. In other words, if the facts did not support the dominant theory, which was being promoted by the Smithsonian Institution, then those facts should not have been published. They should simply have been cast into oblivion and forgotten, which is basically what happened. However, some of the artifacts from the California gold mines are still in the collection of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. They're not displayed to the public. They're kept in a storage building a few miles from the museum, but they are still there. And a few years ago, I got permission from the directors of the museum to study and photograph them. And it was a very difficult process. It's not something that the average person could do very easily, but I did get permission to see them, and they are still there. And actually, I've gone into the Sierra Nevada Mountains and relocated some of the old 19th century gold mining tunnels where these things were originally discovered. So it's a fascinating case. But as you mentioned, it's also a part of the country where there are many reports of Sasquatch.
Yeah, you know what's funny, Michael? Here a while back, it was a couple of months ago, I was reading something and somebody was putting your work down and invalidating it. And the premise is Michael Cremo gets most of his information from Vedic literature, and that is supposed to discredit. And I started thinking that would be like saying Lewis Clark didn't really discover anything because they used a map. You know, it wouldn't make any sense at all. But yet they use that to discredit
you. Yeah. Some people do, and my reply is, I'm not asking you to accept something because the Vedic literature, the Puranas, say it's possible. What I am saying is this. If what the Puranas, the Vedic histories say about human origins is true, then we can predict there should be, if we look at the history of archaeology, reports by professional scientists about discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints millions of years old. That's a prediction you could make. Now, the question is it true or isn't true? And I think I've demonstrated it is true. There have been reports by scientists like Dr. Whitney, a Harvard University trained geologist who published through Harvard University reports of discoveries of human artifacts and human bones found in layers of rock up to 50 million years old. And there are hundreds of cases like that. So it's not that I'm asking these skeptics to accept something simply because the Vedic literature say it's possible. What I'm doing is I'm presenting factual, scientifically reported evidence that happens to be consistent with what the Puranas say about human antiquity.
Well, let me get this straight. You're asking skeptics to look at the facts?
Yes, I do. And I'm asking them to be skeptical, not just about things that go against their deeply held beliefs. I'm asking them to apply the same degree of skepticism to their own commitments and maybe admit the possibility that there could be evidence that contradicts beliefs that they so deeply hold. And if they were true skeptics, I think they would actually be open to the possibility that perhaps their way of looking at things is in need of some modification. And one thing I found is actually there are scientists who are open to these things. I'm able to present ideas like this at mainstream international scientific conferences because there are some open-minded scientists who are willing to listen to new ideas. And I think that's an important first step. Actually, my latest book, My Science, My Religion, is a collection of 24 papers that I've presented on these topics at mainstream international conferences on archaeology. So that's something I think these skeptics should be aware of.
Yeah, times are definitely changing. Okay, I have another question I'd like to get your take on. Actually, it's two questions, but I think they're interlocked. One is on, what do you think of Planet X, Nibiru, and why is it that you think, like, let's look at our history. The only ancient civilizations we can see are the ones that use 20 and 100 ton blocks to build their buildings. Everything else seems to have disappeared. So it seems to me that something happens on this planet that completely reformats the surface of this planet. And now with all this talk about Planet X and Nibiru and even NASA admitting that they're finding other big bodies and we might be a part of a binary star system, and there's all kinds of videos, and you have to be really skeptical when you look at a video on YouTube, but there are some almost, you can't hardly even imagine how they could fake them. But there are some videos out there about there's something else showing up around the sun once in a while. And once in a while, we have two horizons. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're right in suggesting that there have been periodic catastrophes that have, I mean, you said reformatted the planet. I would say have wiped out life on this planet. So I think that's a definite possibility. And in my thinking about this, I have been influenced by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which do speak of periodic devastations that wipe out life on Earth, and after which the Earth has to be repopulated. And these periodic devastations are connected with the concept of cyclical time that's mentioned in the Vedic literature. And the basic unit of that cyclical time is called the Kalpa, or the day of Brahma. It lasts about 4,320,000,000 years. It's divided into subcycles, 14 subcycles called manvantars, each lasting about 300 million years. And after each one of them, of these manvantar periods, there is a cosmic devastation that wipes out life on Earth. According to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in the middle of the seventh manvantar. So that means there have been six manvantars before us. That means six devastations. Now, if you look at what modern science says, what modern paleontology and geology tell us, they tell us life began on Earth a couple of billion years ago, which more or less corresponds to the beginning of the Kalpa, or the day of Brahma. And modern science tells us that since that time, there have been six major extinction events spaced at intervals of several hundred million years. So I think it's kind of an interesting parallel that modern science tells us that over the past 2 billion years, there have been six major extinction events, the last one being the one that wiped out the dinosaurs about 65 million years ago. And ancient wisdom sources like the Vedas tell us essentially the same thing. There have been six major devastations after which the Earth has had to be repopulated. And the Earth gets repopulated, according to these Vedic sources, from higher levels of the cosmos. It's sort of like cloud computing. You know, many people these days, they store their songs and their photographs and files on the cloud, in the cloud, so to speak, so that if their device gets destroyed, their smartphone or tablet or PC gets destroyed, the files and programs and songs and everything is up there and it can be downloaded again and you can restore the system and the files on a new device. So I think there's something like that that happens in the course of our history on this planet, that there are periodic devastations that take place, but the resources to reformat or reboot the system are there on higher levels of the cosmos. There's some kind of cosmic intelligence that's arranged for that so that the resources are there to reboot the system down here on Earth when these periodic devastations take place. So that's how I look at that topic.
So what do you think about Planet X and Nibiru? Do you think this is a real phenomenon that's happening right now?
Well, in principle, I don't have any objection to it. That, I mean, different researchers in the alternative history field get their inspiration from different sources. Some get their inspiration from the Sumerian text, and basically that's where the idea of Nibiru comes from. Others, like myself, get inspiration from the Vedic text of ancient India. So it doesn't speak necessarily about the planet Nibiru, but it does speak of periodic catastrophes and the idea that we're not alone in the cosmos. So there are some parallel ideas there. In principle, I don't have any objection to the existence of planets like Planet X or Nibiru, whatever you want to call it, that might be responsible for periodic catastrophes that affect the life, the course of life on this planet. But, you know, I'm just being honest about my personal commitments here.
So I know you must be more than familiar with it than I am. I wrote a book a while back called To Believe or Not to Believe, and it was about the social and neurological consequences of belief systems, the filtering out that you talk about. It got me into reading into the Sumerian text and the Mahabharata, and then I started realizing about Vimanas, and they had been talking about these crafts for thousands of years ago, and it also seems like there have been nuclear catastrophes on this planet also. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. The ancient Sanskrit writings of India do describe Vimanas, or spacecraft. And here it's important to understand that according to these ancient Sanskrit writings, we exist in a multi-level cosmos. You know, there's one level of the cosmos that we inhabit that is dominated by gross material energies. Then beyond that, there's another level of the cosmos dominated by more subtle mental and intellectual energies. And it's inhabited by beings adapted to the conditions there. People may call them astral beings or jinn or gods or goddesses. There are different names for them, angels in different cultures. And then beyond that, there's what I would call the level of pure consciousness. So according to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are vimanas that originate in all of these three different levels. There are vimanas made of pure consciousness. There are vimanas made of subtle energies. And there are vimanas made of gross physical energies. And there are elaborate descriptions of all these different types of vimanas or craft. And we could get into the details about some of them if we want to do that. So, yes. And you're also correct that some of these ancient Sanskrit writings, like the Mahabharata and others, describe weapons that resemble modern nuclear weapons. They were called Brahmastras. Astra means weapon, and Brahma means supreme. So there was a weapon called a Brahmastra. And if you look at the descriptions of the effects of it when it is used, sometimes it says it would be as if you had millions of suns all gathered together in one place. That gives you some conception of the level of energy and heat and light that's associated with this weapon. And it sounds very much like a modern nuclear or thermonuclear weapon. And it's an interesting fact that Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, who was the physicist who was in charge of the American program to develop an atomic bomb during World War II was, in addition to being a great physicist, he was a student of Sanskrit and the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. So he was aware of the descriptions in those ancient writings. And when he was present in the bunker at Alamogordo, New Mexico in 1945, when the first American atomic bomb was tested in the desert there, it stated that when the explosion went off, he began reciting texts from these ancient Sanskrit writings. And a reporter once asked him, well, what was it like to be present when the first atomic bomb was set off? And he said, the first in modern times. So you're right. There are some interesting hints of
technological. It was that statement, the first in modern times, and him standing behind it, that lost him his top security clearance. After all those years of doing top secret work, that and the statement, I have become the destroyer of worlds, lost him his top secret clearance. And from that point on, he was outcast. He was on the fringe.
Yeah, that can happen. You know, there are tremendous pressures that can be put on scientists to conform. I remember once I was speaking about what I call the hidden history of physics at a university in Europe. And my audience was about 100 physicists and graduate students of physics. And I was going through the history, what I call the hidden history of physics, how, for example, Pierre and Marie Curie, who are very famous physicists, they were husband and wife. They both got Nobel Prizes in physics for their discovery of radium and different phenomena connected with radioactivity. That's in all the physics textbooks. What's not mentioned in the physics textbooks is that they were heavily involved in psychical research. You know, they were doing experiments with mediums who had psychokinetic abilities. So I was going through this whole hidden history of physics with them, you know, telling them about great physicists who have investigated things that are now called paranormal. And one of the physicists came up to me afterwards and said, you know, Michael, I'm very happy that you're speaking about these things. Let me tell you something. He said, by day, I'm a plasma physicist. I do the physics of superheated gases. He says, but privately, I'm doing some experiments in telepathy. You know, I have a son, you know, he's, you know, 8 or 10 years old. I put him in another room and then I flip a coin and my son in the other room has to guess if it's heads or tails. And he's getting 80% correct, which kind of indicates there's something paranormal going on. Right. He says, I feel safe in telling you about this, but I wouldn't speak to any of my colleagues about it because they would think I'd gone completely off the tracks and it would kind of be very damaging for my career. And I see that a lot as I travel around the world. It's something you were also mentioning, that sometimes you run into scientists who, from the external point of view, look completely orthodox in their views. But if you scratch a little, dig a little deeper, you'll find they have some other interests that they would feel very uncomfortable about revealing to their colleagues.
And you know what the ironic part of that is back in the early 1900s, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, Einstein, all of these people, consciousness played an integral role in everything that they were talking about and doing, but as it sort of was came out into the academic world and to the world of people, it was diffused of all of that consciousness talk. And we were pretty much stuck with what we've been taught up until recently. Here recently, things are starting to change.
I think you're right about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting world that we live in, and we're seeing it change right in front of our eyes, and it's changing exponentially. Whatever's going on in the consciousness realm is really pushing us and driving us into areas that it's hard for us to keep up because we're such linear thinkers. We think in a straight line, but what's happening is more spherical. And we can't quite grasp the exponential growth of consciousness right now, but it's overpowering our society and our civilization.
Yeah, I think the general public is already there in terms of these things. I mean, Gallup surveys have been done about people's belief in the so-called paranormal and UFOs, extraterrestrial beings, reincarnation, all kinds of topics. And there are substantial percentages of people in the United States and in other countries who already accept these things, which are completely outside the boundaries of what's being taught in the official tax-supported education system and, the scientific institutions. So, and then, as you're mentioning, and as I've had my own personal experience, even within those scientific institutions, you run into many people who have ideas that are different than the prevailing orthodox ideas, but they're kind of keeping them to themselves. So I think that's a situation that can't go on for too much longer. In one sense, it's almost like what happened with what happened to the communist system in Eastern Europe. It was in power, it was being forcefully pressed on the people, but the people really didn't accept it. And even within the ruling circles, there were those that had doubts about it. But still, the system persisted for many, many years until finally there was a complete breakdown of it. And I think we're going to see something like that happen in terms of our worldview, because it doesn't seem to be a very stable situation for those that are trying to hold the line on a lot of these topics. They somehow or other they've managed to convince governments to give them a monopoly in the education systems so that other ideas are excluded and the proponents of those alternative ideas are marginalized, as you were saying. But there are so many alternative ways to communicate these days that I think it's becoming more and more difficult to maintain that orthodoxy. And eventually, maybe sooner than we know, it's going to change.
Now, you know what's funny, Michael, is unknowingly, you could call them the cabal, the Illuminati, shadow government, a lot of different terms for it. But unknowingly, even as human beings, we sow the seeds of our own destruction when we're doing something wrong. And what we're doing right now here on the internet is something that they didn't count on. They didn't count on the free exchange of information that's getting out there. They have no control over this. And I think that's like pulling back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz. That's like 1,000 people screaming at the Emperor, "Hey, you have no clothes." Little by little, interviews like this, people doing the work that you're doing, getting out there, it gives other people the courage to get out and say something, do something, because it's been our own silence, our own apathy that's allowed this to happen. But people are starting to wake up now and realizing that we need to start talking and getting this thing turned around, because we live in a society that is completely unsustainable. You know, we've created a financial system that's totally based on commercialism, that's totally based upon using resources, and has to infinitely grow to survive. And we don't have infinite resources. It's bound to collapse. So all of this is good, man. I think, Michael, we're looking forward to a challenging, it's going to be challenging, but I think we're looking forward to a world that once it redevelops on solid ground with more conscious people, more spiritually enlightened people, I think we can straighten this thing out. But it is a race against time, because there's some powerful forces right now that would rather just tip the whole board over. And that's what they call World War III. But there's a lot of people fighting this now. This conversation goes on and on and on, and I tell you, we get into some really interesting territory. So if you want to listen to the rest of this conversation, visit www.spiritualactivist.com, or you can also visit www.youtube.com/lotusguide, and you can see even more interviews there. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you.